We are back from a short hiatus. This is the Council Connection. I am your host, Fabian Vixen, and in today's episode, we have my friend, FOP, Steve Sharp, and a future FOP, Caroline Perry, professor at University of California, Long Beach, to discuss Watchmen, COVID-19, and we're going to tie it all in together to social justice and everything that's happened in the 2 weeks. You do not want to miss this conversation. Of course, my housekeeping items and my final thought on the last 2 weeks. This is my part of the show. I say, let go. To the Council's Connection. I am your host, Fabian Vicks, and I have two very special guests on the line with me. First, we have a professor from school council professor from Cal State Long Beach, Caroline Perry.
Hey, la professora. ¿Cómo está? Thank you for having me.
I'm doing well. No problem. And we have a friend of the show, FOS, the other half of the Cuts of Counselors, El Presidente. Steve Sharp, Pennsylvania, president-elect for the School Council Association.
I'm doing well. I'm going to make this podcast very clear. I am not here on official Pennsylvania business by any means. My opinions are my own for this podcast, but most of my public opinions that I speak on behalf of the association are very similar to this sometimes. But yeah, let's do this.
We've got the formalities out of the way. Before we start, going to our discussion about a lot of the events that have just happened the last 2 weeks. How's everybody doing with the school shutdown, the coronavirus? Do you know anything about when your school's starting back or do a virtual, do a hybrid?
We're doing something that involves education somewhere, and we'll make it the best that we can. That's all.
Yeah, I'm at the graduate level, so my students are going virtual in the fall. Well, virtual right now in summer session, so I'm teaching summer. But as far as our K-12 schools, I know guidelines were just released yesterday, so we'll see how and what school districts decide for fall.
Yeah, I was just writing recommendations for different plans throughout most of today, so yeah. Who knows? I got a magic 8-ball if you want to figure it out, though. But as long as our kids have a safe summer, that's the best start.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I agree with you on that one. All right, who wants to start? Pretty much everybody knows what the podcast is going to be about today. So, how do y'all want to? What do y'all want to start at? You want to start at?
I know that we were trying to talk about offline for a while. I think it really was a question of how we best wanted to frame now, because now feels so intense, but at the same time, I feel like it's kind of distant. It's very easy to talk about right now protests and police-related violence. And I know when we're talking about, there's also a lot of context that goes into it. It's like, these aren't the first protests. This isn't the first death. And just what makes it special. And so I don't know if we want to roll back. I know we were talking just text on how Watchmen predicted this. I thought that was a unique turn just to start the conversation. But I thought there was a lot of value to that too. So Caroline, just for full disclosure to everyone, Caroline's been my personal Watchmen therapist throughout the first season. I'm not sure if I would have been able to make it through without her. And again, this is me expressing my deep appreciation.
Yeah, absolutely. It was great having those discussions with you.
Yeah. So I don't want to sound disingenuous as far as starting with Watchmen, but I think it's a good place to start just to ease in, because it covers so much important ground, I think, for people to understand the context of today. Probably 2 minutes into it, and they were showing the Tulsa massacre. I'm like, Are they showing this? They wouldn't show this on TV. They're showing this on TV. Mm-hmm. And then, like, you watch in disbelief as really this surreal violence unfolds. And it's surreal, but they really took, I believe, deliberate efforts to really reflect how surreal the real-life situation was, including not just the rampant violence on the streets, but planes bombing an American town. Like, when we talk about, like, really white supremacy as being a key aspect as far as domestic terrorism, there is no better visualization than talking about the Tulsa massacres as a piece of that. And then after you're done watching it, I was left in disbelief wondering, is this, like, actually the direction that they're choosing to go with the show, or are they doing something sensationalistic to start things off and it'll be abandoned a few episodes in? But yeah, what were some of your thoughts?
Yeah, I felt the same way. I mean, I was in disbelief that that's how they were starting Watchmen. And so I was kind of like, all right, let's do this. But then also cautious, right? Like, how is this going to play out with the rest of the season? And I think, you know, they did in a similar way, they provided some context, right, to the storyline. And I'm a Watchmen fan. I was a fan of the comic series. So I was interested in seeing their interpretation of Watchmen and what they were going to do with it. So I think this was a very poignant way of interpreting the comic.
Yeah, I mean, like, the original comic, I feel like for me, is a lot of things, but an anti-racist narrative, it is far from that.
Yeah.
And so I did not expect this Watchmen to be that vehicle. I can say that very clearly. And what I really took back from that is, even though they showed this very clear racist scenario, that's not quite the same as telling a liberation story. So it was really, I think, as it continued to evolve with the Sister Midnight character, and what I'm going to spoil it. So if anyone is interested in this podcast, go back, get your HBO now or whatever it is, and then come back. Because like the fact that they really do a great job of telling, like, a great anti-oppression story, where they take, like, really a black woman and make her the most powerful person in the universe. I mean, that is black futurism. That is black fantasy in all the right ways to really help us imagine what a world could be if. I thought that was awesome. But
yeah.
What were some of your reflections or things that stuck out?
I think it also just acknowledged the role that black women play in society, right? That is often ignored. So I think it was helpful to finally see that being portrayed, and to be seeing a black female so nuanced, right? So strong and yet vulnerable.
Yeah, I thought also at the same point, like, for Hood of Justice as well, to take also these pieces as far as exploring black masculinity at the same time, and then, like, diving in and exploring his sexuality at the same time. These were much different narratives that you would come to understand through a typical comic book narrative, let alone something with the name Watchmen, I would say. And I think the parts that stuck out to me the most, though, were not the things that were unfolding for us on the screen, though. It was what was happening off screen. Because, like, what became more apparent was, like, they were really deliberate when it came to the construction of the story as well. Like, the story was apparently written as a response and rooted in, like, Coates' case for reparation. And I guess, like, Damon Lindelof had read it, and so all these different aspects and themes that he had read in that, he wanted to somehow incorporate into this narrative. And so, like, when we think about truly, like, an anti-racist piece, this is, as far as television series, it's really one of the central anti-racist pieces that it's based off of. And it's, again, like, I've been talking a lot over the past week, 2 weeks, as far as what anti-racism is and is not. And, like, I think there are a lot of people that, I'm not going to say confused, like, they turn their attention to what we know more often than not, which is the relationships, the people around us, and how we treat people, mm-hmm. whether we treat them with dignity and kindness. But anti-racism is rooted in the process. It's rooted in systems. And so even the process, as far as formulae and writing crew, they were very deliberate. They did have seasoned writers on there. They also had some people who had only one script off of their belt. You could see they're very selected to have both when it came to race, gender, and sexuality and experience, a broad range of experience that I think created clearly one of the most in-depth stories that I frankly can recall when it comes to nuance and dimension. So I really like it because it's not only, you know, like as a Sixers fan, trust the process. Like if you really understand like how to do liberation work and you trust that process, it can create really amazing results. It's about, I think, not just about survival. It's about creating exceptionality, if you can really believe that.
And I think with that, you know, it speaks to, you know, being intentional and being deliberate and being thoughtful in what you do and reflective when it comes to anti-racist work.
Yeah, you know, like, it's funny because I feel like a lot of the language when we talk about, like, mindfulness these days and, like, intentionality, it comes to things like stress relief, like moving beyond the trauma of our day-to-day lives. But really, again, being thoughtful and deliberate, really with those, being intentional when it comes to things like being inclusive, like being aware of the oppressive system and trying to create systems to counter that. Yeah, that's, I'm not going to say stress relieving, but I am going to say relieving in different ways. So The Watchmen is pretty dope. That's all I wanted to say. Good talk, guys. I'm going to hang out now.
You bring up a lot of points with The Watchmen, and you know, I shared an article. We briefly talked about it through text, and this one symbolism that I saw, or a type of shadow, some folks might say, with police with wearing masks, and you see the mask of police officer wearing it to cover their safety. But at the same time, Don Johnson's character, before he became police chief, wore a mask of being a Ku Klux Klan leader. To me, that's a parallel to the 60s and 50s and 40s with the Ku Klux Klan wearing masks, and they're also your judges or your police officers, your butcher at that time, your milkman, even sheriffs or even major politicians. So
talk about the role of the mask, I think it's pretty clear. Like when we talk about like the 1980s and the Watchmen then, like that was with the competing and the Cold War, and it was about who gets to have the power. And here in the 21st century, I mean, when we talk about the fact that like any of us could walk out our doors as educators, go get a carton of milk, and for something as simple as leaving our house or picking up our cell phone or going to a party or asking someone to leash their dog. Like these are things that have like that hidden tax. And so like the message of like this Watchmen, HBO's Watchmen, I think is really who gets to be safe. Like the mask, like through their privilege, they get to wear a mask to provide anonymity. Like again, the Klansmen got to war, had the privilege of exacting violence, but for their own safety and dignity, they got to wear a mask through it all. And like, while black bodies would sometimes like be stripped naked and burned and hung. So I think like the real question is like, when we look to the Watchmen now and we look to some of these commentary now, when we see that recently there was a Klan march or something, a white supremacist march that was protected by police as they were carrying their firearms, or even better yet, more clearly, you could swarm a state government building in Michigan with your firearms and have a peaceful protest, but the peaceful protesters could then be sometimes met with rubber bullets or tear gas, which is again banned in warfare as a chemical agent. Like there's a real question as like who gets to be safe and who gets to make those decisions to be safe. Then the challenge as far as to any of the listeners is, as you become aware and ask these questions as far as, is it equitable when you ask that question? Like, as listeners, if you're asking, is there something that's playing out across the system to support this? Then we really need to then take those next steps as far as what can we do through action, through policy to change that? And that's the anti-racism narrative. Again, like just kind of speaking to it, the chief, Don Johnson's character, he was a very friendly guy. He had a warm relationship with Sister Midnight, and he was a member of the Klan. And so, like, relationships, I think, are central. They're central to our humanity. They're central to, I think, being healthy individuals. But relationships are simultaneously something that exists not fully inside, like, anti-racism work. Like, anti-racism work is focused on how people interplay, but it's also focused on what are we doing to change the system.
And I think Watchmen, you know, it focused on how white supremacy is just embedded within society, within, you know, policing and, you know, at the government level, right? The senators that were a part of this plan, right? Major spoilers. But, you know, it's not just that, right? So white supremacy exists in our education system. It's built and is an inherently racist system that wasn't intended for, you know, let's be honest, it wasn't intended for black and brown students. It wasn't built for us. So kind of recognizing that is a part of that process, that the institutions that you once thought were safe and equitable aren't. And for some people, that's going to be hard to come to terms with.
Yeah. There's
so I want to bring up another parallel before we actually get discussed on discussing our social justice and everything else we talked about through text on the last week. Another parallel I just found interesting. We have an actor or a reality star as a president. I believe it's Robert Redford was the president, if I remember correctly, right, on Watchmen. And we have Mr. Trump, reality star, greatest president ever. He's the biggest, baddest man here. That's my impression of him. But
I'm just saying, if education or music don't work out for you, I'm just say, like, impressionist, consider that. You're safe.
I think I'm safe because my impression is terrible. But the parallel I saw was Redford really and Trump are similar as far as Watchmen in real life right now. Redford didn't know what he was doing. Jeremy Irons' character left him a video on how to what he already planned for the future. And also, if I remember correctly, I think Redford was still the president when Jeremy Irons' character, I cannot pronounce his name, was president for what, 30 something years, if I remember correctly? Something like that. And the parallel to that also is Trump is thinking he's not going to be able to leave office. He's going to stay as long as he wants to, like he's a monarchy or something. So just a small parallel I'm looking at, because you guys already nailed everything from Sister Night through the exploration of sexuality, exploration of a strong black woman, the exploration of possibly, you could also look at possible PTSD from Sister Night having with PTSD with Sister Night having putting the probe into Mr. Manhattan. You can deal with that, and that aspect also you can deal with that too. Look at the
PTSD of having to experience her grandfather's memories, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, we do talk about how, like, the toll of generational trauma.
Mm-hmm.
And just how that echoes through. And I think I feel like just the generational trauma, I feel, is the best marrying when we talk about the real life personal impact that these these racist systems exist. And like, we were just doing a YouTube roundtable the other day. It really was like, when we talk about it, is through coronavirus, we were already putting the tools together to have a trauma engaged response for our students whenever we get to see them next. Like, but at the same time, it would be, particularly now, it would be absolutely negligent not to note and have the same tools available as far as to have a trauma-engaged response when it comes to the collective impact, when it comes to racism at our students. And this is absolutely for our students of color, but for our white students too. Like, there's a great piece out there. I'm not going to remember the guy's name. And it really talks about how, like, it explores a lot of the damaging effects that, like, racism has on white people, too. Like, the reality is we do not have a collective healthcare system. We do not have a broad-based security net. And this, most by numbers and by percentage, impacts, like, white people who have been the largest voting body against such implementation of these things that exist strongly and healthily in other countries. Like, I think the best illustration too, just as far as broad-based commentary, would be like the Second Amendment rights. And like, we understand there is a really compelling piece in The Atlantic from years ago, which I think really talks about the fact that, like, the militias that are referenced in the Second Amendment are actually their slave militias, and that these militias were meant to have the right to bear arms to prevent slave uprisings, because things weren't always zippity-doo-dah. There's always a constant struggle for liberation when it came to enslaved people. And so as there's been a larger and larger push and advocacy for gun rights here in the 20th and 21st century, what we also see is a very alarming rate of suicide, particularly by what we understand, like, middle-aged to older adult men, white men, by firearm. And that it's very concerning, again, that, again, these tools that, again, home safety has been a narrative that has been publicly racialized at different points. It's also been a tool where people are dying by their own hands. And whether it be police-related violence, whether it be suicide, what we understand is these deaths, they're preventable.
When we talk about generational trauma, and the trauma that our students experience, I think it's, you know, one of the things I tell my school counseling students is, you know, we touch on generational trauma, that to expect that some of their parents are coming in with their trauma, right? So the K-12 system can be a traumatic experience for Black and Brown students. And so when we're working with our parents, kind of recognizing that they may come in with some sense of trauma from that experience. And so how do we work with that? Because I can say I know when I talk to my parents, they've had some pretty traumatic experiences in high school, and, you know, pretty racist things that were said to them. And so our parents, our K-12 parents, are coming in, you know, with some of those memories. Mm. And so how do we acknowledge that?
Yeah, I think the unique part for us, particularly as school counselors, is that we have the skill set to be uniquely in tune to both receive and hear those narratives and understand how they are deeply personalized and how we can validate and respond to that. And at the separate point, again, as agents of systemic change, we can understand how these archetypes, these narratives, have played out before in the historical narrative. The one part we were kind of musing about, one of my friends, Dana Weil, and I were talking about a little bit, and I think there's something noticeably absent when it comes to the comprehensive school counseling model, if we're truly to be agents of systemic change. I think in the area of where we define, or you know, like if you're kind of older like me, that foundational area, like I think there's a place where we need to talk about where, like where we're looking to our ethical standards, where we're looking to like our mission and vision, all this stuff. I think there's actually space where we actually need to orient, where we need to understand the historical context of oppression, opportunity, also in those like those defining pieces as well. Because if not, we run the risk then from the gate of building delivery programs that like might be serving an oppressive agenda that we're not aware of.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I came up with that one day ago, and now I feel like I really won't run with it.
Yeah, I think it's you know, one concern of mine is making sure that school counselors aren't coming in with like a savior mentality, right? I'm here to save these children versus being a servant, right? Servant leadership. I'm here to serve my student population. I'm not here to save them. I'm not a savior coming in on my white horse to, you know.
I watched Dangerous Minds like 7 whole times. I'm ready for this. I'm really sorry. No, I think there's a lot to be said there. Yes.
Now you brought up generational trauma. I'll go back to 1619 if you want. We want to go back in depth. 1619, still going on. And how can we advocate for therapy in our Black and Brown communities? Because we don't like going to the doctor. We don't like going to therapy because we don't want anybody in our business. That's the old quote a lot of folks say. And how can we advocate for it without being pushy for our older generation, so that our students' parents, so that way our students, when they become parents, they see that, hey, we might need to do this like my parents did, so that way they won't be dealing with the same thing they dealt with that I'm dealing with.
I think there are a few different ways. At least in my opinion, one of the most powerful things that our students can have is school counselors, and having school counselors at appropriate ratios that they can see their school counselors. You know, I feel like just in the staff that are in my district, and like elementary school counselors can create those warm and open environments. They can introduce students to the helping profession. This can be some of the first and most powerful tools to illustrate that how, you know, like therapy and counseling can be a gift. And then, I mean, in addition to that, like, I don't know, I think part of it is just kind of renorming it with, like, I mean, there's a whole public health piece where just providing that broad-based information to demystify a lot of the work that we do. I think that's also really beneficial, something we can do through our roles as school counselors as well. But yeah, I'm not sure. I haven't really thought of that before.
So I just want to backtrack so we could cover everything while we got you on here, because I just want to.
Fib, you dropped like something great. Like, I want to do like a shout out when it comes to really whether it be like a case for reparations, the 1619 project, you know, like Stand from the Beginning, like a shout out to Black Scholarship. And like, the reality is, I feel like what's going to be different as far as Black Lives Matter is that I feel like there's broader support when it comes to the scholarship and literature to really point to the value and the implications and the guide to work. Like, not only do they have like the spirit and the faith to point to it, like every time they're coming with receipts, and that is very hard to ignore. Like, one of my favorite places to follow is like the RISE Network and stuff like that, because like Black data matters, and I think it helps to really illustrate the disparity and lend voice to all the different work. And where then it's not a point of arguing. It's not a point of perspective. Like, you're able to let the system and the bias of the system speak for itself.
You bring up the biases and everything. Now, you know, I live in Georgia. I don't know the number for Pennsylvania or California. California is a way bigger state, so I know that's a lot more data to disaggregate from that end. But I could just speak from my viewpoint in Georgia. I could speak from going to ASCA the last 2 years. Anybody doing the virtual
yeah,
ASCA?
Not this year, no.
I'm still torn if I want to give them $179 to be at the house. I know it's going to be a lot of great sessions and everything. I'm an in person. I'm a kinetic person. I got to see it and actually be in person. I could, because I'm zoomed out. To be honest with you, I'm zoomed out. Google Meet out.
Well, teamed out. It dropped today, and I think there were some problems that they might have pulled it out. But if you can still find the link out there, ASCA was committing a scholarship of up to 100 school counselors to participate for $0.00. So if you can still find the link, if I can still scrape it up somewhere, I'll shoot it over to you. These are good opportunities to participate, and the sessions are available not just through the normal ASCA window, but I think for the following months.
Okay, cool. I might have to find the application. But I didn't mean to digress on that, but how can we endorse, advocate, install more professional school councils of color to help deal with the issues of the old generation saying generational curses, or dealing with the contextual oppression, implementing a comprehensive school council program that fits in an urban school? How can we push for those numbers to balance out with more African American counselors, more Hispanic counselors, more Asian counselors, more American Indian counselors? You get my drift. More my counselors of color to be more represented in our populations.
I have some ideas. We've done some policy commentary. I've been part of some work groups, but I'm interested just from like the counselor educator perspective, how you feel we can best impact that pipeline.
So we're actually, me and some colleagues are actually in the middle of writing a manuscript on this, on how do we increase the pipeline to counselor education, right? Doctoral students. And I think a few years ago, I did a speaker panel and how do we move school counselors of color to the professoriate. And I think it's just like anti-racist work, right? It's continuous process. It starts by recognizing that, you know, white supremacy culture exists within counselor education and within admission practices, such as the GRE. I mean, my program is pretty diverse. I live in LA, or we're in Long Beach, but we do the work. Like, it's all year long, constantly thinking and rethinking and retooling. How do we increase our representation, and how do we make our environment responsive to the populations that we serve and prepare them to work in urban schools? And so, you know, examining some of those structures, that those long-held structures in the ivory tower of, you know, what it means to be a competitive applicant. You know, part of white supremacy culture is the idea that everything's objective and fair. You know, when we know that the GRE doesn't predict how well one will do in grad school. And so kind of calling those systems out and asking yourself, why do these systems and structures still exist?
So,
I think it's also in my, you know, again, I speak to my program. So this year we spent the whole year reading a book on biases and unconscious bias, and actually, like, professors actually practiced How do you interrupt conversations that are you know, have are microaggressive and have racist overtones? Like, how do you as a professor interrupt this and stop it and create inclusive classrooms and respectful classrooms? And so it's doing the work, right? Every month we were practicing and talking and engaging and talking about what works and what doesn't work. So it's more than just kind of putting out a flyer and hoping that individuals come. It's doing the internal work of how am I creating a climate where they want to come?
Yeah, that's awesome.
And that they're respected and valued. And so even in our mission practices, what does it mean to be a good school counselor? What qualities are you looking for? What do, people have to offer that would make them a good school counselor? And on the way we look at it, it's a pretty wide range. We have people coming from lots of different backgrounds because we acknowledge that everyone has something unique to contribute. And then it's mentoring, right? So the idea that you see leadership in your Black and brown grad students. You see those qualities of leadership and that you acknowledge them and that you uplift them.
Man, I want to be one of your students.
My students are awesome. I love them. I learn from them just as much as they learn from me.
Get on Ray Professor now. Yeah, just for anyone who's listening, when we talk about the school counselor of color pipeline, it's like any career skills. And the reality is, like, for a lot of us, our career education wasn't sufficient. And we always see careers as being an endpoint and not part of a system, not being part of a pipeline or pathway. And so the reality is that a lot of our students are coming from very racialized experiences, very oppressive systems, long before they've ever applied for college, long before they've ever thrown their cap into the air and turned their tassel, long before they've ever applied to a school counseling program. They've been systematically omitted since then. And so, in Pennsylvania, we've also talked about things like magnet programs, cohort models of support, through both high school and through post-secondary to just further secure that pipeline so that students can reach any sort of postgraduate experience after that. Those have been some of the strategies too, but all the things that Caroline is saying, I'm endorsing it being dope.
Oh, go ahead, Steve, I'm sorry.
No, that's it. I was just going to continue to talk about how dope it was.
Now, we discussed Watchmen. We discussed generational oppression, generational trauma, going into Black data and the data showing that we don't have enough council of color to implement school council programs, comprehensive programs, to a system that is racialized when kids hit K through 12.
It's pre-K.
Pre-K.
If you want to add on to that, there's a really great book, Whatever It Takes by Paul Tufts. It's early childhood. But yeah.
So let's all tie this all into the last 2 weeks with George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery. You go back to Tamir Rice. You can even go to Trayshawn Martin. You could do the Eric Gardner, Mike Brown. The rapper that was killed last year in L.A.
Nipsey Hussle.
That's a different extent, but everything we talked about tonight, how everything we talked about this just down the last 36 minutes can tie into what we can do going forward for our communities and how to how to end systemic racism and bring about systemic change in a, and not just a movement, where a movement goes and stops, or a revolution, it goes in a circle and stops and starts again. How we can make this go forward into systemic and viable policy change.
Yeah. All right. Let's do this. Yeah, I think the reality is, we talked about it already. Like, education is simultaneously a system of oppression. And absolutely, I believe, this is why I'm still proud to be an educator, it can be a system of liberation as well. I think from the anti-racism perspective, it is being aware of that constant tension and being mindful of it. Like, with that being said, like, from the educational standpoint, like, it's just about knowing, like, there's a world out there that exists. Like, if we're talking about, like, police-related homicide and the deaths, and, like, really, that is eclipsed by just overall use of force. And the ACLU has more than been able to point to the clear disparity when it comes to use of force. And sentencing, and like when we talk about those things, we understand like there are other countries, there are other G20 highly developed countries with diverse populations where this is not nearly the same issue. You can turn on the news within the past week and you can see other countries from around the world, whether it be in Amsterdam or in Paris, or I think I saw Sydney and like, what was it, Ontario, like there are other countries marching in solidarity because they understand like violence has not been racialized. Well, it has been racialized in these ways, but at least when it came to using their police force in that manner, they've at least addressed it when it comes to having very clear use of force guidance and limiting the lethal measures available to them. You don't even have to go far. Like Camden defund and disband their police department, I believe in 2012, I want to say, 2012, May 2014. And part of the restructuring of the police force when they went to a countywide system was having very explicit and very clear use of force guidelines when it comes to things like de-escalation, escalation, use of other tactics before lethal means. Like these are some very common sense things. Like before I was a school counselor, I was a crisis and behavioral health counselor. And there was this one point where we had these seclusion rooms. We called them quiet rooms. And the quiet rooms used to have doors that you could lock. And the rules changed from we couldn't lock the doors to we couldn't have doors at all, because the reality is that children were dying in these rooms. Adults were dying in these rooms. And so we had to come up with new strategies and new tools. And the answer to that is we did. And the more training experience I had, I don't believe that people simultaneously became better over time. I think I had more tools to interact with people in a non-physical way that in my final years on the job, I never touched anyone. And so I think there's a real question, and we can look to it internationally, we can look to it domestically, of we as counselors need to make sure that we are providing our students with the tools to engage in the broader world so they understand and have a context for things and not just the world that they're in. So it's more easily to recognize when they are being met with injustice and then call for policy change. That's one thing that I think that we can absolutely do.
I think, you know, how do you create policy change? I think it's important to realize that it takes, you know, there are people who've been doing this work for a long time, you know, school counselors, and it takes stamina and it takes endurance. It doesn't happen quickly. And I think that's the most important piece, because my concern is, you know, when things get hard, people will back down.
Yeah.
And it's going to challenge relationships. It's going to challenge your relationships with colleagues, with, you know, part of being an ally is sometimes, you know, giving up some of your own power and privilege. And it will require that. And so I think it's important for people to realize some of that work as well in order to be in it for the long haul.
There's nothing sexy about policy work.
Not at all.
But and so I mean, like, the reality is that part of it, I think, is also, I'm not sure if like you can. I do think there's part of it which is kind of reframing that narrative. I think there is a lot where if you look to like some, particularly since like 2016, like some of the work, whether it be with the development of Indivisible, helping to help people understand how they can do grassroots advocacy, whether it be what we saw, the rise of mentoring and coaching groups to bring more women and more people of color into the traditional political system and coach, support, and mentor them by cohort to further develop those public-facing identities. I think these are also a lot of tools that, one, are good just community-based services, but also when we're looking for our students to get more plugged in, I think there are, if we can get plugged into some of these organizations and groups and be mindful of them, we have a little bit more agility to provide our students with more of those systemic skill sets through some of these organizations and activities. I know, like, for at least we do a young women's leadership group about once a year in my school. We've definitely tapped into some of those to bring emerging politicians, women of color, in to talk about their journeys, to help our women to see different public leaders, and in addition to understand that narrative and have those as role models as well.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I think school counselors, if they really tap into, you know, who we are and what we do, is which is relationship building, right?
Yeah.
If we really dig deep and work on those relationships, because that's really what it is, if when it comes to policy work, is building relationships with even some of the most challenging people to make sure that progress happens. And so tapping into those skills is critical.
And I think when we were, like back in, I was fortunate enough to be on like the ASCA Ethical Standards Committee back in 2016 for our state. And at least one of the things that I was challenging that we put in is kind of this fundamental piece. And it, like, I think it's becoming, there's more ability for us to have this conversation now more than ever. And the reality is, I think we as school counselors do have an ethical duty for our students to understand systems of oppression and understand historic oppression.
Mm-hmm.
And I, like, there are other educators and they might do it, but I do think there is a centralized role to it. And for us to them to understand that, I think it helps to further provide them with the language tools to take ownership and action when it comes to entering the workforce, especially when we talk about like the 21st century workforce, like education, including school counseling, like, is absolutely, opportunities are defined by zip code. And we understand that zip codes have been defined through racial segregation as being highly colorized as well. And so we need to understand, like, I think in addition to making sure that our students, if you look to like future of work research, like, we need to make them well aware that post-secondary is going to, options are going to be almost a necessity. In addition to that, separate to that, they need to be looking at what skills they're developing to navigate the 21st century world. And then in addition to that, we need to make sure that they are ready to have a certain level of career adaptability, because the job that they walk into will likely not be the same job that it looks the same as far as responsibilities and skill sets, like 5 years and 10 years into the job. And absolutely, I think they need to understand the structural and systemic barriers that they face navigating through the system. I think these are things that are clearly played out in the literature and when we look into it just by the raw data. And that's something that I think we need to equip them with. And it's not saying that gaming for a young Black woman that she can't go into technology, but she does need to understand that there are systemic barriers in place. And in addition to that, we will be working for to promote a more equitable place for her at the same time. That way, like, I feel like they'll be more likely to do things like, at least in technology, tap into things like cohort or mentorship programs or seek outside supports while they're working into some of those very lucrative careers.
I don't have nothing else. Y'all got anything else y'all want to talk about while we're on here?
Yeah, I mean, I guess the only other things that we really, I think, in due diligence should talk about is really like the impact of school closures and COVID. And I mean, I don't know where to begin or really where to end, but like we talked about, we put it on like some of the broadcasts we put out there. It's just the common narrative that we understand. Again, like here in the United States, particularly in places with a history of like residential segregation, we understand the quality of our students' education, particularly overall, but exacerbated during school closures. It's drawn by zip code. It's absolutely, in addition to that, drawn by racial lines. And that is, it's heartbreaking. It's discouraging. We understand like access to technology, access to just material resources like food, it's different by just a couple of like a 5 or 10 minute drive sometimes. And I think that's one of those things where questions like, what can we do as school counselors, both now and moving forward? I think, like Caroline said before, like we build relationships and trying to maintain systems that promote connectedness with our students. I think that's something that, whether it be office hours or emails or calls or letters, these are some things that we need to really challenge so that we can make sure that those threads, those connections to our students maintain. Particularly when we come back from, whenever we return to our schools or as people start to return to our schools, we're going to see students where school has always been that safe place, and maybe they have not been in a safe place for weeks or months at the end. We're going to see students with ongoing mental health problems that may have exacerbated due to lack of access to care or due to continued isolation. We're going to see students who, again, may have absorbed some of this collective trauma. And then in addition to that, we're going to have students who have probably had maybe really benefited from the in-person bricks and mortar learning setting. And they, in the cyber setting, have, like, they've definitely lost some academic ground. And the question is, what are we going to do? Like, the one part is, I think having systems in place to really gather information from our students beforehand, whether it be sending out a questionnaire or something like that, that's going to be something that's going to be easy to do. And you'll get the face value of having those direct responses from your students, but also understand the students who may have been systemically excluded from the normal pathways of communication already. And those are students that you can already put into some level of support or higher levels of outreach or communication. And then in addition to that, I think, geez, like there's going to be a lot of people who are going to be making calls that a student has a learning disability or some sort of has a learning disability. They might be looking through a referral, put through a referral, and at the same point, it's not that a student has had a learning disability. Like, they have possibly been spending the past 3 months trying to watch and educate their younger siblings because their parents are both healthcare providers and working or something like that. And I think it's very important for us to make sure that we're supporting the student and providing them a chance to make gains, but not the same point to understand that special education in and of itself, much like education as a whole, is simultaneously a place that can be a tool of equity or a profound oppression at the same time. I think there's going to be also, as we're looking to renorm our students to the school environment, really we're going to need to call out and question what our discipline practices are and the value in place of exclusionary practices like suspensions and expulsions. And I think there's also, like, if we're in some sort of hybrid form where we're either doing continued distance learning or on a day off a day or on a week or off a week, like, if they're doing some sort of, like, adapted attendance program that somehow monitors academic engagement as a tool for monitoring students, whether a student's attending, those are places where we really need to start stepping into our axi boots and really question whether or not a student's lack of access to high-quality education and support, or the fact that they're absorbing parenting duties, or a lack of internet access, or perhaps home's not a safe space, are we double penalizing them? There are plenty of different equity conversations that need to happen, and the real place is that we as school counselors have a lens that is trained to tune in to ask the questions. We as school counselors have a voice where we can raise questions to our administrators that, even though this might make sense because it's easy to catalog students as being here or not here on whether or not they completed a worksheet or assignment, is that truly in the end capturing, like, whether a student has the ability to engage in school? Like, if we're not sending buses out and a student doesn't come to school, is that student absent or did we not send the buses out that day?
Mm-hmm.
These are kind of, I mean, the reality is, like, COVID and the ripple effects on both public health, mental health, and our economy, those are going to continue to evolve in ways that I don't even think that we're understanding yet. And as a result, we understand in the same way that's going to happen in education as well. Like, some of the things that really challenge our counselors to do is the things that we have control in. Is absolutely over the summer, look at your August through March data. Like, aggregate it, look at it. Because right now, the students that we know aren't going to walk through the walls of our school come next August, the students who might have had profound impact, like, we don't need to wonder who they are. We already have a pretty strong data set to understand, like, students who are doing well, they probably did okay. And students who are struggling in school, they're probably doing a lot worse during the school closure period. And then there are more than a few that were impacted in ways that we don't even know yet. But for those ones that you already have a snapshot of, like, take that snapshot so you can make sure that you have places, whether it be mentorship, whether it be some sort of intervention or enrichment for their instruction. Like, you have a chance right now to look at your data to understand that. And absolutely right now we understand both state and local revenue dollars are going to be depleted. And if we have a chance really to use our comprehensive school counseling skills to demonstrate the story, to tell the narrative of the value of the work that we do, surfacing students regardless of the setting, that's, I think, a very powerful narrative to have on hand right now.
Yeah, I think you're spot on. And I know spot on with, I mean, everything.
Oh, that means a lot. Thanks.
I think, you know, our state organization has partnered with our SoCal ACLU for a couple of years now. And one of the things that we did was we sent out a survey to high school students across California just to see, you know, how are they doing? How are they handling COVID? And I think what came to light really, and we know this, right, is the, you know, the relationship between healthcare access, and economic status. And even just who's at risk, right, for COVID. And many of the students talked about how their biggest anxiety came from the fact that their families and their parents were essential workers, right? And so, I mean, it came up pretty often that their biggest concern was that their parents were at risk, that they were a population that was at risk for COVID, and now they have to work, right? Because there is no, for some, you know, some of our work, we have privilege, we get to work from home, or someone can take a step back, but these were families that were struggling with their basic needs already, and now they're putting their health at risk. And what is the impact on students who are watching their parents take that risk? And some students who reported, you know, that they're now working because they don't want their parents working, so they've told their parents to stay home and they'll go out and work. And we have to acknowledge that that's the reality for some of our students. Another concern that I have, just with the return to school, and just regulations and guidelines for what that should look like if it's in person, and, you know, the mask wearing, is how do we create safe and welcoming environments for students when they return, because they're going to be experiencing grief. I think people assume that it's going to be this kind of happy thing, we're going to come back, but there's going to be some grief upon their return, because it's not going to be the school that they once knew, right? It's going to be very different. And with that comes a sense of loss. And so are we prepared for that? And how do we handle just maintaining these safety guidelines? So students who maybe don't take the mask off, or, you know, how do we make sure that we're not punitive in these guidelines, that we don't turn back to those punitive measures with students if they're not maintaining a safe distance, or they took off their mask, or they hugged each other? How do we not fall into those punitive discipline practices?
Yeah. And I joked with our dean of students when we said, wow, this was our best quarter yet. No suspensions. Huh. Yeah, I mean, I've been talking a lot with school counselors nationally over the past 2 weeks about a lot of different topics, and I think the reality is right now is absolutely right to feel like there is a crisis. There's not a crisis. There are several crises going on, and at the same point, I think, for school counselors with our ability who have experience working in crisis to see opportunity and missed opportunity unfold in front of us, that's also a unique lens that we have. And with that being said, like, as counselors who do this more than 180 days every year, I think it comes back to those core things that we can do, which is to seek the additional training, to seek the additional professional development. And we understand what it is. I mean, absolutely, continue to develop training on social emotional learning, trauma, distance learning tools like technology. But absolutely, if you have not yet, to understand, to take some time to understand, like, when it comes to anti-racism approaches and practices, this is absolutely a great time. And that could be like, do the Ask a Book Club, read Stamped from the beginning, How to Be Anti-Racist, White Fragility. Everyday Anti-Racism is another great educator's guide to anti-racism. And the list goes on and on, because we understand there's been a wealth of anti-racism resources out there. And the one part I'm going to challenge is being clear. I think I said it before, I don't know, I can't tease out my conversations at this point. Like, anti-racism work is different than diversity, equity, inclusion work. Diversity, equity, inclusion work is good, and there is no There's no problem with people who do diversity, equity, inclusion work, and that work should be celebrated. But anti-racism work is absolutely about changing systems, and we as school counselors are meant to be systems change agents. I could continue to talk on. We could talk about counselors versus cops. We could talk about all sorts of things. But in this time, I'm just happy to share even virtual space with the two of you.
Well, Steve and Caroline, I appreciate y'all taking time out this evening to pop on my podcast for me. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. It was a great conversation.
It's been a good conversation.
Maybe next time we can put some cussing in it next time, Steve. Damn right. You're damn tootin'. All right, y'all folks have a good evening.
Have a great evening. Caroline, I'm speaking on behalf of Faye, but I think we need to officially issue friend of pod status moving forward.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Awesome.
All right.
FOP. FOP. Friend of the podcast. FOP. All right. Appreciate y'all. Y'all have a good one.
Take care. Thank you. All right. Bye-bye.
You take care.
All right. All right. All right. All right. We'll be right back. More Council Connect. This is a part of the show where we do our housekeeping items. And as you know, my podcast can be heard on Spotify, Anchor, Google Podcasts, Breaker, Pocket Casts, Overcast, and Apple Podcasts. You can follow me on Twitter, the Twitter at Fade the PSC. That is at FAB as a boy, E the PSC. You can follow my website, fadethecounselor.weebly.com. It's under construction. As friends of the show, folks that follow my podcast know I switched schools, so I got to update it to my new school. If you go to my website for Anchor, anchor.fm/Fabian, F-A-B-I-O-N. Dash Vix. You could click on the link that says leave a voice message. You can leave a voice message, ask a question, or leave a comment, or how you think we're doing, how we can improve, or some things we need to talk about on the show. Hopefully future guests will have, I haven't reached out to him yet, an official capacity, Mr. Brian Coleman, 2019 School Council of the Year. Hopefully I would love to get him on and just talk about his thoughts on a lot of stuff and pick his brain on some things. I'm working on Dr. Beverly Stewart from Bibb County, her role as a student support services coordinator in Bibb County, and how her role is going to will help advocate for counselors, students, and families, especially right now with the coronavirus still impacting families right now. And hopefully, if you were listening to this podcast and you're a regular listener, you like to hop on here. I'm on Twitter. I'm on Twitter, and you can hit me up. I would love to have you on. We could just chop it up about anything. I'm versatile. I'm flexible. I'm pretty knowledgeable on some things, so it won't be too bad if you want to hop on here. We can talk about anything you want to. With that being said, I'll be back with my final thought on the last 2 weeks. So the last 2.5 weeks have been draining, stressful, scary, liberating, needed, warranted, unwarranted, timely, untimely, by any means necessary. Those are the mixed bag of emotions that all Americans are seeing these protests right now. And some of the things that I've heard from some friends and from people on TV and just in conversations in passing, why y'all protest? We don't need to tear stuff up. Why tearing stuff up? Well, folks don't realize that when people get tired of something, they tolerate it and tolerate something. to a point where you add in you've created a perfect storm of coronavirus / COVID-19, where everybody's been in the house pretty much since March, except for essential workers. And shout out to those essential workers. My part-time job is considered essential, so I've been working also. You also add in Aubrey being killed in Brunswick, Georgia, Breonna Taylor, Kentucky, George Floyd, Minnesota, more recent. But you also add in Tamir Rice, Sandra Bland, Trayshawn Martin, Eric Garner, Mike Brown, Emmett Till, Malcolm X, Martin Luther King. Your ancestors back in the 1800s, when they're trying to get freedom. We are dealing with something that has been an issue since 1619. On our interview with Steve and Caroline, we talked about a generational trauma. You could date that back to 1619. This is not a political podcast. I'm not a hater on any race, but I'm just a person that's a thinker and look at different things and how it affects us now from then. As African Americans, we have never been taught to grieve, to go to therapy, how to handle our issues. We've been taught to survive and adapt. We haven't been taught how to tell how we feel, how to channel our emotions. There are some folks that do it. I'm not saying every person of color does not do that. But as a diaspora of blacks, we have been trained to survive, adapt, keep it moving. Onward, forward. Where we cannot compartmentalize our emotions. We have to compartmentalize our emotions to what has happened to get through the next day, which creates a generational trauma for ourselves, for our offspring, and our offspring's offspring. So there are things right now that in the world that's happening with the blow up of social justice again, and the pace picking up again with Black Lives Matter. It's a great movement. What can we do as individuals in this diaspora? What can we do individually to keep pushing forward this movement? To end the social injustices of police brutality or systemic racism, zip code racism, as well, Steve put it in our interview. What can we do? Some people say, y'all don't need to burn nothing up. Well, I read an article a few weeks ago. If you're a black-owned business or a business that is very successful and they destroyed your business, what impact did you have on the community? If your business had an impact in your community, those people know not to mess with it. That's an article I read. I can see the value in that. I can see the points, but at the same time, that's a form of anger that these protesters are showing. I'm not going to call them rioters, because we didn't call the people in the Boston Tea Party rioters. They're fighting taxation without representation. We just don't want to get killed by the police. We just want to live. We're just trying to make it through today. I'm trying to make sure if I drive my car up and down the street, I'm making back home to my family. on a daily basis. I just want to make sure that if I'm pulled over, is this my last time? Was that my last time seeing my students? Was that my last time seeing my wife and my kids? Was that the last time I talked to my mom on the phone? It's just hard to think about right now. And I should be sad, I should be angry, but right now, Philando Castile, forgot about him. He sat in the car, girlfriend recorded it, Facebook Live. Guy gets off the hook. But back to my original question, what can we do as a diaspora of African Americans or Hispanics or Asian Americans, people of color, people that are not the majority in these United States? What can we do right now to end the systemic racism that's going on in this country? Part of another podcast for Valley Boys. We talked about making sure you go out and vote. We got to have the right candidates to vote also. We have candidates that have our interests in heart and in mind for those things to happen. We got to make, when we do vote, we got to make sure we're not just voting for president, because this is going to be the most important election this year. This is not a political podcast. I'm not a political person, but I did major in political science. Go and vote at all possible elections. My friend Horatio said, do your 2020 census. Do your surveys for your communities. They're looking for ways to improve. And we don't fill those things out, they're going to say, oh, they're good. They're Gucci. They don't need nothing. Knowing darn well your street lights are off, your hurricane sirens not working, there are 15 potholes on Sherland Drive or 15 potholes on MLK Drive. There's a street light not working on. There's a light not working on I-75 at night or early morning, you going to work or coming from work. What can we do? That's just one part of the aspect. The major part of the aspect is talk to our kids. Teach them the history of what's happened, because the history books are not going to teach it. They're not going to teach everything. Talk to them about the Tulsa Massacre in 1921. Black Wall Street Massacre. Talk about how we didn't get the right to vote until 1964. We didn't get the right to live where we want in 1960 until 1968. I said, I believe in my last podcast, blacks have had full rights for less than 60 years. Less than 60 years. So you think that our ancestors and those people integral in the part of getting blacks to vote and getting the same rights that were in the Constitution, we were living here. We got to use those things. One last key to helping our kids and helping this nation push forward through these social injustices and systemic racism, especially our kids of color, we need to have them go to HBCUs, especially our athletes. We want our kids to have the best. I get it, no problem. My baby want to go to Clemson. My baby want to go to Alabama. Fine schools. But what are those schools are going to prepare them to do after they 4 years of eligibility is up? them, they're just a number. They won in 33,968. They're just number 8. They plays wide receiver for LSU. Not bashing PWIs or any other colleges, but for our kids that are talented athletes, those schools are looking at them as a number. HBCUs look at them as family. I want to thank you for listening to my podcast tonight. I want to thank Steve and Caroline for dropping in on me. And I'm out.